Mixed marriages, so often regarded as a problem, can rather be seen as the connective tissue par excellence between separate Christian communities. Thus, the partners deserve to be given all possible pastoral help to share as fully as possible in the life of both communities in which they are involved, and to bring these together. End of quote. The connective tissue referred to is that which grows over a wound, enabling it to heal. If only this were recognized more widely by our churches. And if we can give our experience of double belonging, not yet, as Ruth said, canonical reality, but experiential reality, if only our churches could recognize that and give it pastoral support, much more than at present, our very existence would become, as the Pope said, an effective sign of unity between us. Of course, the experience of double belonging of our children is even greater than that of their parents. They've been brought up since children to share as far as possible in the life of the two churches of their parents. And many feel that they belong to both equally, and are unwilling to be confirmed in one if it means cutting themselves off from the other. By Roman Catholic rules, of course, a literally joint confirmation service, at least at present, is not permitted. But both in Canada and in England recently, pastorally sensitive clergy have permitted celebrations of confirmation or affirmation in which both churches have been able to participate to some extent. Pastoral vision is needed, and we need to suggest to others how they can help us to do as much as we can together. What interchurch families ask of our churches is that they give continuing attention to who we are, what our experience of double belonging, double participation, double insertion in two churches, however you like to describe it, means, and our churchly significance for the developing ecumenical situation. And I was very grateful to the Bishop Mark for focusing upon that. We bear witness by what we are, but also by what we do. By regular attendance as a family in two churches, we can provide a regular channel of communication between the two. And just as marriage partners live in one another's lives, so we can encourage our two churches to begin to live in one another's lives, to pray for one another regularly, to celebrate major festivals together, to participate frequently in one another's services, and to engage together in service of the local community, as we heard from Craig and Michelle. Yes, Churches Together in England, the National Council of Churches in England, is at present encouraging its member churches to participate in a process they have called Together in a Common Life. Well, surely we have something to contribute to that. And Gilles graphically described the early chapters of the Acts of the Apostles, how that reflects the experience of many interchurch families. We do share all our resources. And then interchurch families can get involved in the ecumenical structures of their churches at local, diocesan, district, national and international levels. It's already been mentioned that Ruth and I were privileged to be invited by the Pontifical Council for Promoting Unity and the World Council of Churches, respectively, to talk with their joint working group in May about interchurch families. At least as significantly, the previous May, Dr. Mary Tan of our Interchurch Family Panel of Reference was in Mississauga, if that's how you pronounce it, near Toronto, for the World Meeting of Anglican Primates and Presidents of Roman Catholic Bishops' Conferences, who seek to turn the level of theological agreement so far reached by our two communities into commensurate joint practical action. At that meeting, we understand, there was much discussion of interchurch families from bishops from all the continents represented. nationally, both in churches together in Britain and Ireland, the four nation body covering Scotland and Wales as well as England, and in churches together in England, we have an interchurch family representative on their respective councils. And both of these representatives have shown themselves so valuable to the council that both councils have also elected them onto their steering and executive committee. And if you want to know more about that, talk to Jill, who you saw so ably present the British report this morning, because she's one of them. And I know that some Australian interchurch families have also been represented on their state councils, and also in Germany, the German interchurch families are deeply involved in preparing for the first joint Catholic-Protestant Kirchentag in 2003. So we can get involved with our churches at a much more organisational level if we have the time and if we present ourselves to the churches. So we can be witnessing to our churches both by our very existence and also by working with them on their unity path by our actions. I said earlier, in critical solidarity with our churches, we perhaps need more confidence to share our experience with our churches. One of the things that we have discovered, for instance, the possibility of admission to communion of the non-Roman Catholic partner at Mass, what we have discovered in talking to some of our bishops, that no one ever asks me. And I suspect that's because so many of us fear being turned down. But if we have the courage, it is something which I think will begin to change the pastoral situation. But perhaps we don't need even to go that far. We need to press the churches gently but firmly to turn their professed commitment to unity, their remarkable discoveries of doctrinal agreement, into much more commensurate action. We would like to see many more joint celebrations of baptism, and not only for the children of interchurch families. We want to see the churches working much more closely together in preparing couples for marriage and setting them in it. So many of the marriages, as we've heard, and so many of the children brought for baptism come from mixed marriages, whether they are practicing interchurch families or not. The birth of a baby, the preparation for a wedding, are times when many people are open to the wonder of human life and love, and therefore open to God. Yet for so many mixed marriages, these are times when clergy clumsiness turns them further away from God. So we need to make our needs known to the churches. One of the disappointments, I think I should say, of Ruth and myself in the One Bread, One Body document is that whereas the Vatican documents talk about spiritual need, the One Bread, One Body talks about pain. Pain is not the same thing as it. And yes, of course there's pain, but the important question, is there genuine spiritual need there? And we know that in so many cases there is. I wanted to finish, I came across this morning to try and think, now, how on earth am I going to finish this morning? And the words came to my mind of a marvellous poem which was turned into a hymn many years ago by, it's a 19th century poem by Arthur Clough. If anyone knows it, I'd love to be able to quote it properly to you, but probably it's much too ancient for any of you. It's about the waves battering on the coast and trying to remove the rocks in the way so that it could get further inland. And it begins, "Say not the struggle naught availeth, all the something and pain is in vain." And then it says, after saying that the water is making no impress on the rocks, it says, "Turn round look behind. Through creeks and inlets comes flooding in the main. I think interchurch families are creeks and inlets through which God is helping to bring the water of life back into the unity of our churches.
So much that is rich, solid, challenging, opening to the future. I think I'll just leave the floor open to questions and to comments. Rudolph.
I have a question to Bishop Wenneth. You mentioned the term domestic church from the Vatican Council, and as was pointed out by Professor Neu in Germany, the Vatican Council also pointed out that the Eucharist is constituted for church. So if the interchurch family also is a domestic church, the Eucharist also is constitutive for this church. Do you agree with this?
It's a good question. Does underline, as people and theologians have said, that the Eucharist makes the church, and the Eucharist is essential for the church. So there is an intrinsic need or call from the communion of the church for the encounter with the Lord in his gift, in his sacrificial gift for the church. And that's certainly the reason why, in spite of the differences of the churches, there is a permission to receive communion, at least in certain circumstances. What would I say? I could expand a little more on what is to be church. The domestic church, so, is a recent concept to some extent. It goes to the New Testament through the Fathers of the Church, in particular St. John Chrysostomus, but it is broader than only what we would call the nuclear family. So father, mother, and two or three children. It's broader than that, at least in the vision of the New Testament and in the domestic vision. So in that sense, the domestic church, which is the small family, is or has to be open to the broader family church, which is the parish or the ecclesial community to which they belong. And the essential of the ecclesiality in the domestic church is baptism, but baptism is referred to the celebration of the sacraments, where in Catholic perspective the minister has an essential role. So in the communion of the domestic church, the family, there is an intrinsic openness or relation to the broader ecclesial community with which has to in Eucharistic contact, and as far as possible, including Eucharistic communion. So, in the special case of interchurch, domestic church, with some restrictions and limitations, precisely because the broader communions are not in full communion. And so this situation is shared, this pain and work towards the future is shared by the bigger communion and the smaller communion as being one family with many cells in this organism, in this body of Christ. You have many cells, so we cannot isolate the domestic as it would be a self-sufficient church in itself. I don't know if it answers your question.
This is perhaps more of a comment, but also to raise an awareness. We talk about, this morning we've spoken about two, let's say a Catholic couple, both baptized and living out their family or their marriage, and in contrast or in comparison, an interchurch couple. My wife and I, just from experience, my wife and I participated in the Archdiocese of Edmonton marriage preparation course years back for about 16 years as a resource couple. I'm a Roman Catholic and my wife Bev is Anglican. We found that after the first year of being this resource couple, we were only addressing our comments as in our lived experience to those couples who were presenting themselves as interchurch or mixed marriage couples. We found that we would try something else. We decided to change that session to faith commitment. In other words, everyone would attend, not just the breakout group of the interchurch couples. And we, to our amazement, it was very relevant. I hope that we're not assuming that just because two Catholics enter marriage, that there's something magical that happens and that the level of faith commitment is the same, because it is not. As a matter of fact, we found that some of the disparities in some of these proposed relationships, these were engaged couples, presented way more problems than, let's say, two Christians contemplating marriage. So I think we need to really remind ourselves of that. Really has a lot to do with levels of faith commitment of two partners, and that we can't lose that sight just because they may be of the same denomination. So there's something else there that I strongly believe that interchurch couples have to consciously work harder at their spiritual, their domestic church challenge than a couple who are from the same denomination. So it's really important.
I agree.
My question goes to Bishop Quellett. My Lord Bishop, on the participation of the mixed couples in the Eucharist in the Catholic Church, a talk you mentioned that according to the canons you quoted, the couple can participate in the Eucharist permitted by the Eucharist, permitted by the ordinary, provided the Eucharist is respected. And then you went on to cite examples of how some countries give permission to the couple during special occasions in the church and special feasts in the church. I think this is an improvement and a step towards ecumenism in the church. But however, we have a long way to go. When a couple in a mixed marriage is going to have their marriage, we ask them to attend course. Sometimes I wonder in my parish, that can't we also have something like marriage preparation course for these couples, so that in other words, at the end of the day, there could be a law to allow them to be continuous participants in the Eucharist when they have undergone an Eucharist preparation course.
Quite understood the question, so I think it was saying, why don't we have a Eucharistic preparation course for spouses in interchurch families, and when they've taken this course, if they're sort of regarded as suitable, they will be able to take the Eucharist on an ongoing basis. That's right, yes. So it was a question to Bishop Mark. But I must say, it's also something very like what I suggested to our bishops, that they didn't take it up, you know, some years ago.
Thank you for clarifying and interpreting the question. The first thing I would say, since you speak of a course, is that in the preparation of interchurch marriages, and I refer also to what was said previously, there is a great need, a pressing need of preparation to the sacrament of marriage. And so in the Catholic Church, this has been developed over the years, and some progress have been made, because, as was said previously, it is a wonderful opportunity for people who are discovering human love to discover God at the same time, who is the creator of human love. And so to be evangelized, or to experience the faith, the richness of the faith. And so if it is important within each confession, it is twice important in interchurch marriages, so that people who want to marry, they also need to see and understand the implications of being married, of sharing a sacramental marriage, and to see the link with the Eucharistic mystery, and to receive at least a sort of basic orientation and understanding of what the churches who are dispensing the sacraments are saying about meeting our Lord in sacramental marriage and the Eucharist. And from there, I think it would be a wonderful opportunity for the pastors to meet with the couples, to establish a relationship, and to help determine to what extent it could be permitted or indicated or commended to receive communion together. That's what I would say.
that. In other words, this really is a pastoral question.
In the way it was asked, it was a pastoral question. So I can say one more word, maybe, because I think we must not oppose pastoral and doctrinal. Yes. The directory that I recalled is an application of the norm of the Catholic Church. But the truth of the communion must be respected. And the truth of the communion between the churches, which is not fully achieved and has to be worked out along the path that was described by Canon Martin, I think, and where interchurch marriages and families have an important role to play, and I think also a critical role, as he said, in order to help to adapt to the growing union between the churches. As I said in my paper, the growing communion, the steps toward fuller communion, will allow a modification of the practice, of the norm. But so we have to be pastoral and at the same time respectful of the partners. And we cannot consider the church just as a sort of abstract identity, an institution which is there to impose on us burdens. The church is a mother. It's a family. It's a bigger family of what we live. So, if we have this image of the church, we deal differently with what is proposed or sometimes restricted by the pastors.
Bishop Mark, I often think an interchurch family audience is a really daunting and intimidating audience for a bishop. So I should start off by saying we are all really grateful that you're here and loved your talk. And that, of course, because dialogue with it is what we want. It's so important to us, and we love the spirit in which you spoke. Of course, that's a prelude to a really difficult question.
I'm sure.
I think you were quoting when you said, one of the notes I made, you used the expression, not the ideal domestic church. And I think that was a quotation. I can see many ways in which the domestic church of which I'm part is not perfect. But the interchurch part of it is not part of that imperfection, I think. Do you think it's true to say that actually, because of our shared unity within our domestic churches, in fact, interchurch families are closer to the ideal domestic church than our churches in their disunity are close to being the ideal church. So that in fact we are closer to the ideal as domestic church than our disunited churches are to being the ideal church.
That's a difficult question. let's start with what I said. So I said that interchurch family or marriage is not the ideal domestic church. What I meant was that since you have a difference in faith and traditions and customs and so on, and backgrounds, spiritual. So it does represent a special challenge to foster and maintain and to make sure that the unity of the couple and of the family will last and develop and survive within the context of the greater communion of the church as the bigger family. So just look at the experience of mixed marriages. Statistically, the result in many cases is people distance from the church because of difficulties and the experience of double belonging, which is not understood and lived out in the way it was described here. So it is a special challenge to live the church and to live out the mystery, sacramental mystery of the church within the difference, this difference. I'm not saying that it is not possible and that it cannot bring, as was described here, a great contribution to ecumenism. So, but your question went further than that. It was just the first part of your question. If I understood well the second part, you said that our domestic churches as interchurch families are maybe realizing or embodying the unity of the church better than the churches themselves. So I would have some more reservations on that, in the sense that how would I put it? The one holy and Catholic Church is already given, like the Council said, subsisted in the Catholic Church, and is also present in other ecclesial communities or churches. So we, in other words, if you imply that there is no unity of the church and that the unity of the church is only a sort of goal that is in the future, and so you could conclude that you are, by your living out unity between two churches or ecclesial communities, you are closer to the ideal than the churches themselves. But I tell you that the church as such has already, so we have to maintain two things. The church in itself is one holy Catholic church, not only as a future reality, but as an existing reality. And this existing reality is striving with the participation of all the other churches and ecclesial communities to create or to foster greater unity among the churches. So, and in that common effort, certainly, that interchurch families have a specific contribution to make. And as was said here, that could be more and more appropriate. What you are contributing if you receive the proper help, also an accompaniment of the pastors, and also recognition of what you are doing. Okay?
Mr. Eilert, a short statement and I hope for a short response. First of all, I understand your need of being diplomatic here. We have a German saying, too much fear makes you already dead. Too much fear makes you already dead. Sorry. And we... Sorry, I lost the line now. And so I asked authorities to be more encouraged to allow the sharing of the Eucharist, because otherwise it will turn out true what German theologist Mr. Pallenberg said. The local practice will draft apart from Roman law in an irreparable way. So much work is done for the distinction, what is Protestant, what is Anglican, what is Catholic, and so on. But as the denominational environments tend to vanish, most people do not understand those distinctions anymore. And we of the interchurch families who come together regularly, we talk about our own faith and the faith of our partner. Also, we know about the differences. So many of us work and minister in the partner's church too. And we are tied together by the mutual approved baptism. And we do not want another 100 years of meticulous work on distinctions which are not understood anymore. We have time to be patient, because the central distinctions are quite different today. What does it mean today to believe or not, to orientate oneself by Christ or someone else? And you said we shall trust in the Holy Spirit, but even the Holy Spirit needs a physical person in the Vatican, and so we hope you will be this physical person for us.
Poor Holy Spirit. Should I comment on this?
Okay, good. It's not a direct response. I thought Bishop Mark had finished, but I think one of the questions that has been coming up under the surface, and certainly in the previous discussion here, is what do we actually mean by the unity of the Church? And we've skirted round this at various points. Brother Gilles talked about it yesterday. And I think we need to take a kind of deep breath and look at this whole question again, because I become more and more conscious that when we talk so glibly about the unity of the Church, we're often talking about the unity of the institutional body. And I think Brother Gilles, of course, started at the right end with the unity of God and the unity of the Spirit, and so on. But that does need, as the last questioner pointed out, a physical expression in this world. And I have always liked what I believe it was one of the Orthodox patriarchs first said, but it's been said and re-said by many people of different denominations, including the Roman Catholic Church, since. He said towards the end of the last century, I know where the one Holy Catholic Church is, but I no longer know where it isn't. In other words, he was saying, yes, we are the one Holy Catholic Church, but maybe you are too, and maybe someone else is. And this is the sort of tangle we've got in, and we need to work it out. And that's how I like to interpret the subsistit in of the Roman Catholic Church.
I'm just going to break in for a moment. You may have noticed it's 12 o'clock. However, if Bishop Mark and Canon Martin and Ruth are able and willing to carry on for about another 15 minutes, if that's okay with you folks, I believe that Kathy has already kind of forewarned the dining room and the children's group that this may run a few minutes over. Are you able
to? I would like to add something to the last intervention. I think that you made an important point in saying that we live in a new context, secularized cultures, where it becomes more than urgent for the Christians to come together and really to reconcile and bear witness together. If we want to be credible, so we need to do more than what we've done till now, and to bring more lived experience to the discernment of the churches, so that so a common witness will grow between the churches. And also what you said about the distinctions, that's true, that many distinctions, you know, of the past, they are not understood today, so by the people who has maybe no theological formation. We have to take that into account on the one hand, and on the same time, we cannot decide matters of faith so only on this basis. So because the transmission of the faith is also so a matter of doctrine, of understanding, of confessing the truth of the revelation. And that's an important part of our identity. So we receive the truth that God has given to us in the share that we are invited to have in his life, as was reminded yesterday. So, let's move forward and try to not augment the distinctions, but to search simplification as much as possible. So we have some help in that. Thank you.
One of the things that I feel has changed in the 20 years that I've been associated with interchurch families is the way in which these meetings have been a dialogue with our bishops rather than us shouting at them. And in that, the other thing that we've been trying to do is to find ways of doing things that express what we want to express about our unity, that the church can accept as perhaps meaning something slightly different from what we think it means, but can accept. Now, so far, I pray that it may never happen, most pastors have, for whatever reason, maybe it's because they remember the millstone that could be around their neck, have not said to them, you may not receive in those churches. And that sort of some sort of acceptance of the concept of double belonging. And yet we've been told time and time again that double belonging is not possible. It appears that it is possible. It appears that some people do it. And I wonder if this partial solution to the reception of communion by the parents could be that the churches could acknowledge that in some manner they belong to both churches and therefore could be received as communicant members of those churches.
Why don't you start?
I think this is an extremely interesting and important question. And I was involved in the Church of England in the revision of our canon law in respect of actually acknowledging that there were other churches in England. as we did it, the canon lawyers discovered to their astonishment that the Act of Uniformity of 1662 had not been revised in one respect, and that only Anglican clergymen were supposed to preach in Anglican pulpits still, which has been no doubt contravened for the last 200 years. But in doing this, the group met, and they wrote the new canons, and those were eventually agreed by the synod and the House of Parliament, as it has to be in England still. But we said we think there is a need for members of other churches also to be able to declare themselves to be members of the Church of England. For many, many reasons, not just for interchurch families. And this has now happened. It is an anomaly, it is odd, but it is recognizing a reality that people do go to different churches for very good reasons. In some parts of England, there is no other church than an Anglican church, but a Baptist, or someone may say, I don't want to give up my Baptist membership, but I want to be fully participant in the life of this congregation. So I think there is a way forward there, but this is much more difficult, I'm quite aware, for the Roman Catholic Church. But I am a great admirer of the former Archbishop of Canterbury, William Temple. And way back in the beginning of the last century, the Church of England and the Anglican Communion was beginning to revise its rules about communion, admission to communion. And we have to remember that it's not long since the Church of England had exactly the same position over the as the free churches about communion as the Roman Catholic Church still does. But what a question was asked of William Temple from Azariah in South India. And at that time, the churches in South India were beginning to look towards union, but they hadn't achieved it. And the Bishop Azariah, who wrote to the Archbishop, said, should we admit these people to communion? Now, I'm talking about admission to communion, but theoretically and theologically, admission to communion is the same as membership of the church, which is one of the difficulties. Archbishop William Temple wrote back the following. If you are convinced that in your relationships with the other churches, the spirit of schism has been driven out, then I would allow admission to communion. And it seems to me, from an Anglican perspective, I'm not trying to answer for Bishop Park, from an Anglican perspective, what we have seen is that when there is real commitment, and I mean real commitment, the sort of commitment that we have to unity of our two churches, and a real serious tackling of theological issues, and a real intention to be united. When we reach that stage, I think then these sort of questions can be faced. Because I'm personally convinced that union of the churches will not come by some kind of final fiat of bishops or whatever. It is a growing reality, and that's what I meant by creeks and inlets.
I think that doesn't really entirely answer Philip's question. because this question is basically about reciprocity. You know, double belonging means reciprocity. And I don't see how the Roman Catholic Church at the moment can give its blessing to it. I don't even see how it can give its blessing to the reception of communion in a church where it doesn't recognize the orders of that church. And I really want to stick within the terms of the directory and see all that we can get out of the directory. And, you know, it's quite clear about this question of reciprocity. And I've always tried to steer away from it in England, feeling that, you know, what we can ask for is an extended admission to communion, and we won't deal with the other thing. But recently I've got much more courage, thinking, you know, we have got to talk in terms of the conscientious conviction of the Catholic. And can I commend to you a little commercial? The last article in the current journal, which is about the question of conscience, and I think we have a lot of work to do here in thinking about what it really is, because I think you see that the Catholic Church could go as far as the Bishop of Strasbourg went ages ago, saying that a Roman Catholic who conscientiously receives in the church of their partner, and this would be even more so, of course, for the children, which, as you say, has not yet, you know, been a problem, very widely anyway, that they would respect this conscientious conviction. I don't see how the Roman Catholic Church can go for that at the moment. But I think this could be done, and this would sort of clear the air a bit. But I think, you know, it will take a long time before we get to that point. So I think really this is a far-off question, but one which we have to keep on raising and keep on dealing with out of our own experience. But, you see, the bishop may be more hopeful.
So I thank you for also the answers you have given. I realize myself that I am not prepared to answer that question properly. I need more reflection, and since I am, as you know, at the beginning of this new responsibility, I would like maybe just to stress a couple of points, that the unity that we strive for is a gift from God, a gift. And the double belonging is a difficult concept. We spoke about that before. Membership and communion are very tightly related, as Canon Martin said. And to be fully members of two churches and receiving communion in on a sort of general basis would imply a sort of mutual agreement at the highest level of unity among the churches. That canonically, but so this is not the case. In a way, there, and we must distinguish between church and church. With the Orthodox Church, it should be easier for the Catholic Church, for example, from this point of view, to reach a sort of agreement of that sort, of receiving communion on both sides on the more general basis. With other communions, it is not so easy because of other issues that are in discussion. So that's what I see the problems of the children, the problems or the, I mean, yesterday I was very much struck by what was told and what was communicated, and the example of the confirmation of Sarah, you know who she is, was impressive. I was very much impressed. It was between Anglicans and Catholics, and it was not an absolute joint confirmation in both churches, but it was done in communion, where one minister was so administering the main rite, and the other was sponsoring, you know, with a gesture on the shoulder. It seems to be a nice expression of a unity that is not perfect, but just the fact that the child or the young adult is making a commitment in the context, in the real context of churches in non-complete communion, and we have to take that into account, but with the support of the other church. That's a that's the point where we are at.